Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. In this episode, we feature Ash Davidson in conversation with Jacqueline Fitzgerald. The original live event took place at the Portland Book Festival in November 2021. The novel Damnation Spring by Davidson was one of the most anticipated and celebrated books of 2021. It takes place in 1977 in the Pacific Northwest, near the end of an era when the timber industry dominated the region and a nascent environmental movement is just beginning to take root. A fissure runs through the Gunderson family that threatens their way of life and their very identity. In this conversation, we hear about Davidson's 10-year journey writing the novel, including how she synthesized the massive amount of research that went into it, how she approached the political nature of her subject, and about her own background growing up in remote parts of this country. Damnation Spring is a work of great literature, and its themes and tensions around timber, the environment, and the needs of community to have work and to have their health are deeply resonant with our own recent history here in Oregon. Davidson is in conversation with writer and educator Jacqueline Fitzgerald. Here's Fitzgerald.
I would love to start, Ash, just by talking about the fact that this is your first novel that you've published and hear a little bit about what that experience is like for you. The first experience of publishing and promoting and this whole whirlwind and what that's like.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for being here. It's been pretty darn great. It almost feels like kind of an extended practical joke, and I'm just very impressed that my friends have gotten you and the Portland Book Festival and all of you to somehow participate in it. It's obviously quite an elaborate production. But I think something that really surprised me, because I'm a very introverted person and I'm really consciously trying right now not to breathe too loudly because I'm afraid you'll hear. but what surprised me is that I've really enjoyed meeting with book clubs and small indie bookstore audiences across the country. And I think that one of the great blessings of publishing a book during the pandemic is that people have really adapted to Zoom, and even book groups who've been together for decades have transitioned to that medium. And so from my home in Arizona, I can be in New York in 1 hour and Georgia the next. And it's just been such a delight to hear people share their memories and experiences of the Redwoods and this time period in the late 70s when the book is set. And people on both sides, you know, people who come from families of loggers and mill workers and people who've worked in the wood products industry and people who protested the destruction of the forests in the Pacific Northwest. And I really wish that I'd met these book clubbers earlier, to be honest, because they have so many insights and these astute observations about the book that I would really like to take credit for, but honestly didn't occur to me until some wise reader pointed it out. So it's been great.
No, it's amazing that you're like gleaning new insights from your own book as you're kind of traveling digitally across the country. It's awesome. Can you talk us a little bit about your journey as a writer? Like, what does early writing look like for you? How has that gone?
So I was raised without television in pretty rural areas a lot of the time. And it's funny what you covet as a kid, right? Like, I didn't care that much about TV. I was happy with books. They were what we had. But I really wanted to live on a paved road, mainly because I thought it would be good for roller skating, which was my priority at age 10. But I remember writing almost as soon as, like, I think probably as soon as I could read, I was writing, and usually about the forest. I was very interested in the Amazon. I was a child of the 80s, of that sort of Save the Rainforest campaign, and I was really affected by that. And so, but I, you know, my dad was a carpenter, my mom was a school teacher, so I was very conscious of the fact that I needed a practical skill and I needed a useful degree. So I went and got one, and I worked for several years for a resettlement agency outside of Washington, D.C., welcoming refugees and political asylees when they first arrived in the U.S. And then in 2010, I took this big leap and went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which like sounds pretty glamorous, but I feel like if there are any writers in the room or aspiring writers, I should come clean and say I applied to 11 MFA programs and I got into two. So, and I went, but I had this idea that a serious writer had to write a novel, so I started one before I went there because I didn't want to show up and look like a debutante. And so I started this book, and I think because I always knew that I would write about Klamath, and I would write about the Redwoods, and write about herbicide spraying, because my family lived in this area when I was a kid, and we relied on a creek for drinking water, similar to Rich and Colleen's set up in the book, like a lot of families in the rural Pacific Northwest. And my parents were very concerned about the spraying, and I grew up with all these stories about Klamath. We left when I was three, so they aren't really my memories, but they're so vivid in my mind that they might as well be mine. And so there are funny stories, there are sad stories, there are car wrecks, there are a bunch of sort of cultural miscommunication stories in which my parents are usually the butt of the joke, being from elsewhere. And they were just, it was this beautiful world, you know, the most beautiful place my parents had ever lived. And that beauty was also the source of its own destruction. And it was populated by these sort of wild, zany, tragic, quirky characters. And I just so desperately wanted to get back there. And so this book was kind of my way of building a time machine and transporting myself back into that world and being able to walk around in my parents' stories. And I did use a lot of their stories as scaffolding in the book in the early years. And sort of as the book grew organically on its own, all that scaffolding got stripped away. But there's a quote on the last page of Memory Wall by Anthony Doerr. I don't know if you know that book. But it goes something like, you bury your childhood here and there. It waits for you all your life to come back and dig it up. Mm. And I just sort of felt like Klamath was always there waiting for me.
Mm. When I read this book, I was so struck by how distinct and immersive and rich your descriptions were of both setting and character. And it's amazing to me that just from like those childhood memories and what you've crafted in your imagination that you were able to craft that. But I'm also sure that there's so much research that went into that. Can you talk a little bit about your research in that space, in those places, and how you were able to craft these incredible characters and this rich community?
Thank you, that's very kind. Well, it took me 10 years, and so I had some time to get to know them. But I read a lot to begin with. I read basically everything I could get my hands on, books and newspaper articles from the time. The loggers in the book refer to giant old growth hardwoods as big pumpkins, which is a term I took from a newspaper article at the time. I remember distinctly the moment that I pulled A Bitter Fog by Carol Van Strum off the shelf in the library and just the weight of it in my hands and that feeling. You know, sometimes you pick up a book and you feel like this book was written for me, not for anyone else, just for me. And that it's such a beautiful true story of the grassroots struggle against 245T, not too far from here in the coastal range of Oregon near Alsea in the Five Rivers area, if you know that part of the state. And then I also took several research trips back to Klamath. And I was really, I'm here alone talking about this book, but this stage really should be full of a crowd of people to whom I owe a connection, a piece of information, an introduction, and just such generosity, often from strangers. Like if I had to write like a gratitude map on this on this experience at a size that would be legible to you in the audience. Like, I would need a piece of paper the size of this stage, because people were so generous to me, especially when I turned up in Klamath after almost 3 decades and went to a community dinner with my mom. And you know, we walked in, and it was just like you felt every head in the room turn. I'm sure that wasn't the case, but that's what it felt like, because we were outsiders. And we went through the line, and then it was just like being in seventh grade with my lunch tray, looking at all the tables and thinking like, oh no, no one is gonna let me sit with them. And this woman just recognized my mom across the room, because they'd worked together at Margaret Keating Elementary School 28 years before. This was pre-mask days. And so she took us over to her table, and she introduced me to a man who'd cut a lot of old growth, and he wouldn't talk to me inside. So we went out to the parking lot, and he talked for 2 hours. And the next time that I interviewed him, he brought a photo album with him. And I finally, at the end, got up the nerve to ask him about the sprays, because that's the reason I was there. And I had this really tidy dichotomy in my mind, where I thought loggers are on one side, environmentalists are on the other. And when I finally asked him, he told me some stories about being sprayed over while he was working and how it had affected him. His skin, his eyes, his breathing. He said it felt like, one time when he was doused, he said it felt like his tongue had been sprayed with Novocaine for 2 days. And that just really disrupted this very tidy dichotomy I had in my mind. And when I asked him what was in the photo album, it was all these photos of him as a young man cutting these giant old growth redwood trees, you know, a tree that you could park 2 pickup trucks on side by side. And it was work he was proud of, and it was a skill set that was coveted in that time and rare. Like, whatever you think about the falling of old growth timber, I think you have to admit that from an engineering perspective, it's kind of amazing that a tiny little species like humans can destroy something that large. But there, and he didn't express any regret for that work, but there was a sort of wistfulness in the way that he spoke about it and looked at those photos of himself. And it really struck me that, you know, he works in the woods, but he also recreates in the woods. You know, he hunts, he fishes, he takes his kids hiking and camping, and he loves the woods in his own way. And it made me think, it made me understand that there are many ways of knowing the world, and that I shouldn't be so quick to judge someone for their profession.
Yeah, I noticed myself kind of walking a tightrope as I was reading the book, just being environmentally minded myself and having such a, I mean, the redwoods are just so magnificent, and then also feeling such deep compassion and empathy for the people that are living in the places, trying to survive, trying to have their families there. What was that paradox like for you through your experience of writing the book, and even maybe now? How do you hold those two things together? And also, why is that important for us in these like kind of current times that we're in?
I don't know what this says about me as a person, or maybe just writers as a species, but it never felt like a paradox to me, I guess, because I think people are complicated, and that's what makes them interesting. And I think that as a writer, my job is to empathize with all of my characters, even the lousy ones. And so, because if I don't, I flatten them, and the novel won't reflect the full sort of psychological complexity of the human condition. And so, but I certainly ran up against the limits of my own empathy in the course of writing, I think. I've heard from readers that there are 2 characters in the book who are particularly difficult to empathize with. One is Merle Sanderson, who's Rich's boss, and the other is Eugene DeWitt, who's Rich's brother-in-law. He's married to Colleen's sister, Enid, and he does some truly despicable things. And when I felt that either of those characters were verging toward villainy, I went and looked for a moment of kindness, or a moment of tenderness, or a moment of vulnerability with them. So for example, for Merle, His wife, Arlette, is ill, and she's vain, and she won't go to the beauty parlor in her condition, and so he dyes her hair at home, which is a really uncharacteristic act of tenderness that I think a lot of people who know Merle would be very surprised to see him capable of. And when I finished writing that scene, I realized that, of course, I can't use it because it's a private moment and none of the narrators can witness it. And so I took it out, but I left the hair dye staining his nail bed so that when I saw him again, I would remember that about him. And Eugene is hot-tempered and impulsive and a very violent man, and it's easy to dislike him at moments, but I think it's hard to dislike him when he's helping his little girl with her eye exercises to correct her lazy eye. And so I tried to remember that most people are not monoliths, and so I think that the importance of paradox in writing is like the importance of paradox in living, you know? It's that it's important to remember that a good person can do a bad thing, and a bad person can do a good thing. And I think that you'll see people who fit both of those descriptions do both of those things in this book. And I think it's my job as a writer not to judge them for what they do. And I think it's easier for me as a writer than it is as a person, to be totally honest.
Thank you, Ash. Speaking of characters, I would love to talk about this beautiful family that inform the book. We have Rich, Colleen, and Chubb. Can you talk a little bit about the origins of these characters and how you created them for this book?
Sure. So in case you haven't read it, maybe I'll explain a little bit who they are. So Rich Gunderson is a fourth generation high climber in his 50s, and he's married to a woman named Colleen, who's about two decades his junior, and she's a homemaker, but she's also a midwife in the community. And they have a little boy, Chubb, who's five when the novel opens. And sort of the central tension of the novel is that Rich is obsessed with this giant old growth redwood tree called the 24/7 tree. And it's a tree that he sort of inherited a family obsession with. And when he finally gets the opportunity to buy the land it's on, he jumps at it because he thinks if he can harvest it, his son will have different choices ahead of him than he had as a boy. And the only problem with this plan is that he doesn't tell Colleen. He invests all their savings, and Colleen has begun to suspect that the herbicides that Rich's employer uses might be responsible for some anomalies that she's witnessed midwifing, and maybe even her own miscarriages. And so that suspicion opens up a real rift in their marriage, and it also sort of exposes all these fault lines underlying not just the community, but their own family, and really asks the question of what happens to a community when an extractive way of living that sustained them for generations begins to erode under their feet, both figuratively and literally. And Rich and Colleen and Chubb, and this is going to make me sound like a lunatic, but I kind of feel like I met them, even though I invented them, in that they just sort of arrived the way that they are. And then as I got to know them, I realized other things about them. And I work full-time in a non-writing related field, and I write from 5 to 8 in the morning before I go to work. But even when I was at work, I was in a meeting, or I was answering an email, or I was writing a press release, and some part of my brain was still thinking about them, was still sort of in their world. I was trying to decide whether Rich would prefer lemon to butterscotch, or whether they grew up in families that salted slugs or cut them in half. And I think that I didn't realize until very late in the book, I think, that like oh, I can actually move these people around. I don't always have to follow them. And I realized that I could make a big change even after so many years. So for the first almost 9 years, Colleen wasn't a midwife. She was only a homemaker. And I had read a story about a midwife in the Uinta Basin near Vernal in northeastern Utah, who had started to notice a bunch of anomalies that she thought were related to the oil and gas region in that area. There are about 10,000 oil wells. And that had always stuck in my mind as like, this is the person who would notice if something were wrong in a community because they're seeing everyone. And when I finally made that change, which I was really nervous to make, it was like tuck, 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 tuck. It was like dominoes, just everything sort of rippled out and like fit. And so it was, it took 10 years because I'm slow and indecisive. And also because like it takes a long time to get to know a person. And I think for me as a writer, that's true in fiction the way it is in life.
Yeah. It's so helpful to hear you describe that, because as I was reading it, I was reading that these character descriptions, I'm like, oh my God, it's like she lived every single one of these lives before she wrote them. It was really amazing. I'd love to talk a little bit about setting. One thing I noticed as I was reading the book is how far away the rest of the world feels. And, you know, the Redwoods are obviously right next to the ocean, and Arcata is as well. But I had actually forgotten that I hadn't put that in part of my consciousness when I was reading it until the end, when the ocean starts to appear more. Can you talk more about that, why you made those decisions about setting?
Yeah, so Rich and Colleen live in a spot very near where my own family lived, just east of the 101, sort of between Arcata and Crescent City, north of the mouth of the Klamath River. And it is a very self-contained sort of environment. And if you know that area at all, you'll know that Damnation Creek is a real creek, and many of the place names in the book, especially the creeks, which Rich is teaching his son Chubb the names of, so that he'll have this mental map of the woods in his mind, and he'll be able to find his way home if he gets disoriented in the woods. Many of those place names are real, but I think if you know the geography, it'll be a wildly frustrating book to try to map, because I jumbled things, and I move things all over, and you'll find a river that should be an hour south that has miraculously transported itself north. And I did that consciously, and I felt very strongly about fictionalizing the geography to protect the privacy of the community and to protect the privacy of the place too, because I live in the Southwest, and in our national parks particularly, but on public lands generally, you can really see sort of the stress and the impact of recreation and the tensions between people who live there locally in the communities and people who are coming to experience those landscapes. And so I really wanted to protect that place. And it is, you know, it's very densely forested in the part where they are, because as you know, in the Pacific Northwest, I don't have to tell you, you know that an old growth forest is much more open. These forests where they are, it's second and third growth right behind the house. And so it's grown back sort of in thickets, and it's very, very dense. And so when Rich and Eugene have to walk up to the creek to clear the path to the water line so they can do some repairs, they have to clear the way with a chainsaw. And my dad used a machete when we lived there. And so you do forget the ocean is there, because the woods just sort of swallow you. And it's so quiet. It's easy to lose sort of your sense of direction of, once you can no longer hear the ocean sort of crashing against the cliffs, it's very hard to know which way is west.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of place, I would love to talk a little bit about the indigenous peoples from that area, the Yurok peoples, and what you learned from them. They make an appearance mostly through Daniel in the book, but what you learned from them and how you figured out how you wanted to integrate them into your story. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so the Klamath River and that whole watershed is the ancestral home of a number of tribes, including the Yurok tribe, which is the largest tribe in California. And the Yurok are distinct in the sense that they are still there on their ancestral lands, and they were never moved off to a reservation. And they have a very strong connection to the Klamath River and its health. And still today, if you follow the news, you know that the tribe is at the forefront of getting more water in the river, of protecting against fish kills, of making sure the habitat of the salmon runs is a good temperature, because their culture is so closely entwined with the health of those salmon runs and the area. And it was very important to me that the Yurok be present in this book, because in real life, Yurok advocates were at the forefront of advocating against spraying of herbicides in this area. And I was very fortunate that a number of Yurok people were generous to me in sharing their experience and their stories. And so the late Yurok advocate, Robley Schwenk, who was one of the leaders of that movement, who also worked in a mill in the Klamath area, I went up to see him the first time at his house, and I was terrified because I'm not a journalist. I had no idea what I was doing. And I went up to his house, and we sat on his porch in silence for about 10 minutes. At which point I was really internally starting to panic, like, what have I gotten myself into? I'm going to have to leave. I think he's telling me he wants me to leave. And then a telemarketer called trying to sell him some steaks on the phone. And that kind of broke the ice. And so there were people who helped me in those early stages. As I got to the end, Amy Cordalis, who's the incredible general counsel of the Yurok tribe, read the book and had some really interesting and useful insights, and is writing a book, a novel of her own, because she comes from a family of fishers on the salmon, of the salmon runs on the Klamath River. And so I think, you know, this is a book that I learned a little bit about a lot of different things: logging, salmon fishing, midwifery, how to butcher a deer, like a bunch of skills that I hope I never have occasion to use in real life. But part of the joys of learning that way was you could go very deep down any one of those paths. And I got pretty far down the sort of salmon path until I realized, like, oh, that's not your book. That's a different book. Back up, go the other way. But I'm very excited to read Amy's book. And I think there are many important Yurok stories of the area that I think we'll find a larger audience through her.
Mm-hmm. I think I'd love to talk a little bit about how you're thinking about what the book is bringing now has shifted since these times we're in. So, I mean, I think you said when we chatted a couple weeks ago, you said you had sold the book two years ago. And so much has happened, right? We're in such a different world. And I'm really curious how you think about the book and the world now. Has it shifted for you at all? Or, yeah, what it means for you, or what you think it might mean to an audience or to the world now?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think of Rich and Colleen and Chubb's world as very self-contained. Rich has never been more than 150 miles from the house he was born in, and he's 53 years old when the book starts. And it's not until very late in the book that he ventures past that radius for a very specific reason. And so I think their way of thinking about their world is that they can't leave it. And so that made me think a lot about sort of where you're born and who you're born to and how that determines the choices that you see in front of you. And I wasn't thinking about this when I was writing it, but afterward I have thought about that. This is a book about one industry in one small town, but I think there's a similar book that could be written about probably a dozen different industries in 100 towns across this country, you know, from coal mining towns in West Virginia to uranium in the Southwest, to oil and gas in Texas or Wyoming, because it's really a book about family and about love and about what people will do to take care of and provide for and keep safe the people that they love. And I think that especially in a political climate that's really polarized around everything from the mask on your face, I think there's a real tendency, especially in the environmental community where I work, to blame people who work in extractive industry as if they're somehow the reason for all of the destruction wrought by their industry, and I don't think that's fair. And I've sat in a number of public hearings, like you'll find in the book, on issues from everything from forest restoration to mining. And something that really strikes me when you're listening as an audience member and you hear people get up to the mic is how much pride and dignity there is in work, and also how much desperation people can feel when they have a specific skilled profession that is very much tied to one industry and one place and is not transferable. And so there are plenty of good reasons that a logger in the Pacific Northwest or a coal miner in West Virginia isn't going to be moving to Arizona to work on a solar farm. And I think that it's important in rethinking the future of those industries to remember that there are people who've raised kids and sent kids off to college and built houses and built good lives for themselves off of these professions. And as someone who lives in a house made of wood and wrote a book that's printed on paper, I should not be the one to cast the first stone. And I think that there are a lot of tensions between the needs of the market and the needs of the planet. And there are very few people who aren't implicated in that somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, I love hearing you speak with such compassion. This is actually making me think about your work that you said you did with refugees. Can you talk a little bit about how did your work with the refugee community, how does that shape? Maybe that's connected to what you were just talking about, but maybe you could say a little bit more about that. I'm really curious.
My first real job out of graduate school was working for the International Rescue Committee in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is in the sort of the northern suburbs of Washington, D.C. And I think they hired me because I could speak French, because I had no other qualifications. I wasn't a social worker or anything like that. I had a degree in international affairs. And it was the most rewarding job of my life, and it was such a privilege because I met people from all over the world, from all sort of walks of life, surgeons from Ethiopia and actors from Cameroon and teachers from Iraq. And you know, as someone in their mid-20s who had a limited experience in life, it was just astounding to get to interact with so many people and hear their stories in a time of their lives that was particularly difficult. And it made me realize that there's a reason that only 0.5% of refugees ever get resettled. That 0.5% has one quality in common, and that is almost a superhuman resilience, I think, of like no matter how terrible the experience, the capacity to hope, even when it's sort of hope bordering delusion, is so strong. And it also gave me the experience that I think you could get in a lot of different professions, actually. I think waiting tables or teaching school or working retail, you get this experience too, in that in 3 years, I had over 400 open cases. And so in the course of 8 months, I got to know hundreds of people. And you know, when you work with people in direct service like that, you start to notice things that you didn't notice at first, right? Like small, in the era before masks, sort of small subtleties in expression, a lot of nonverbal communication cues, a distinct way that someone sets an item down or picks it up or holds a pen, or maybe a tell that they have, a gesture that they'll make before a certain type of behavior. And I think that I didn't think of it that way at the time, but I think it was actually really helpful because a lot of times we were working in someone's non-native language. You know, we'd be speaking French, but that wasn't my first language, and that wasn't my client's first language. And so you, and there are a lot of experiences that for various cultural reasons, people won't ask for what they need directly. And so you started to realize that you needed to be watching for other cues. And so I think that was actually very good training for a writer. And I think it was good training as a human being because it made you realize, it made me realize with my personal experience having, you know, still living in the country in which I was born, having access to my family, having access to enough to eat, having access to education, that all of my problems are very small in the scheme of things. And I think that sort of perspective was really important for me to have. And I think, like, I still think there are a number of people who are refugees themselves who are acknowledged in the acknowledgement section of this book, because I do truly think that they are the best representatives of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for saying that. I mean, it says a lot about just your understanding of the human experience, and then also explains to me what you were saying about how you observed their mannerisms and gestures. It's like what is communicated through character in the tiny things in your book is really profound. So I'm like, okay, that's how she did it. Because I'm like, how? A lot of the pages, that's what I was doing. How did she do this? You spoke a little bit to this just a moment ago, resilience. There's so much loss in this book, profound loss. And there's also so much carrying on that's discovered in really unlikely ways, ways that really surprised me. Can you talk about what writing this book teaches you and continues to teach you and perhaps all of us about grief and relationships and community?
Yeah, so Rich and Colleen both lost their parents young. And Rich's father died climbing, just like his grandfather before him. And still, every morning, Rich gets up and goes to work doing that exact same job. And together, he and Colleen have built this really quiet, affectionate, loving home for their son, which is something neither of them really had growing up. And I think watching them through the experience of losing pregnancies made me realize that grief and time to grieve, I think a lot of times, especially, I mean, even for a loss as big as the loss of a baby, grief is a luxury when you have a family to feed and bills to pay. And I think that I was also really struck at how private grief can be. I think for much of the book, Colleen keeps a lot of her grief over losing pregnancies to herself. And it's not until very late that you realize that Rich has been grieving that loss in his own way. And I think that that grief is particularly lonely for Colleen at that time period in the 70s when there was a lot of stigma about speaking about miscarriage. And I think my sense is that that experience is still lonely for many people today. And I think that it made me realize for Rich and Colleen, but also in the larger world, because something that I've been really struck by now that the book is out in the world is how many people have gravitated to the book because they recognize that grief from their own lives. And that there's not a lot of it in fiction, and that people often don't speak about it in life. And a number of people I know and people I don't know in bookstores and by email have shared their own experience of losing a baby. And it really, you know, sent home to me a message that I think people who work in professions like teaching probably already know, because you have to bring it with you to work every day, is that you just never know what another person is experiencing when you encounter them in the world. And I think especially for grief like that, which because it's related to sexuality, we can't talk about it, is people can be dealing with all sorts of grief in their life that you just don't have any sort of insight into. And so when I have an interaction in the world that is doesn't go the way that I would hope, or I feel like the response isn't commensurate with the situation, I try to take a step back and remember that I don't know what's going on for that person in their lives at that moment. And you know, with characters, like, you can see how they act, and then you can go sort of nose around and everything else that's going on with them. But with people, you can't do that. And so try to give people the benefit of the doubt and remember how much people sort of hold back from the world.
Yeah. That complexity that we find in characters is existing in the complexity of a person right next to us. Absolutely. Thank you. I have one more question for you before you read a passage and we take some questions. This is just purely for my own gratification. There's this very tender ritual that Chubb and Colleen have together in the book. Chubb is a little boy. And Colleen will say, where did you get those beautiful eyelashes? Or where did you get those beautiful eyebrows? And Chubb will say, I got them at the eyelash store. Or I got them at the eyebrow store. And I'm so curious about the origins of that sweet moment that they share throughout the book.
So my mom taught school for 43 years, and she's exceptionally good at thinking up creative ways to teach kids vocabulary. So when we were kids, the version in the book is sort of an abbreviated version of a much longer and more ghoulish game that she played with us to teach us the names of our body parts. And in it involved walking into a store that trafficked in human body parts and going up to the counter and asking the clerk, and he would bring down this giant glass jar, like the kind you would normally see like gumballs in, except this one would be filled with eyeballs, and he would take two out and hand them to you and you could put them on. And my mother is adamant that there's no way she would have taught us such a dark rhyming game. And I'm 39 years old, and so it's been so long that nobody really remembers. But I will say that the version that Chubb and Colleen play in the book is much sweeter. And I think really, really conveys the sort of specialness of the bond between them. He is really the miracle of her life, and she cherishes him. And I think probably one of my favorite book moments has been I got a message from a reader who said that she had started to play that game with her own kid at home, just because I think it's such a, there's so much affection in it. She's playing Colleen and Chubb's version. there's so much affection between them, and it comes through that.
Yeah.
So all credit to my mom, Susan Davidson.
Thanks for sharing that story. We'd love to hear a little passage from you, if you wouldn't mind reading for us.
Sure. I'm going to read a section from early in the book. Let's hope my voice doesn't tremble. And I think all you need to know going in is that Rich and Colleen are walking with their little boy Chubb up into the woods behind their home. They're going to cross the creek that separates sort of their side of the land from a grove of old growth redwood trees that are owned by Rich's employer, Sanderson Timber. And the two things you probably need to have in mind going in are that Colleen is still grieving a stillbirth, and Scout is their dog. Rich pressed a palm to the 24/7's bark. Chubb did the same. Colleen's breath scraped at her lungs. After a moment, Rich stepped back and cleared his throat, pressed his thumb along his top lip as though he could smooth out the old scar that ran up to his left nostril. When Colleen had first met him, she thought the scar made him look mean. Now she knew the gesture well enough to understand there was something he wanted to tell her. She'd felt him turning it around and around in his mind all week, like a piece of wood he was deciding how to carve. He took her hand, squeezed three warm pulses. I love you. 6 months ago, it might have thrilled her, but now she knew there was no desire in it. The hospital had flipped a switch in him. As soon as she'd healed, she'd wanted to try again. The doctor had said, wait a few healthy periods, try again. She longed to hold a living, squirming baby in her arms, but Rich refused. He'd stopped wanting her. "I'm beat," he'd say, gently removing her hands, rolling onto his side, turning his back on her. Maybe it was age. She tugged her hand free from his warm platonic grip and moved ahead down the path. "You're it," Chub tagged Scout, sliding down the far side of the ridge toward Damnation Creek, ducking into the brush to hide. "Where's Chub?" Rich asked, sidestepping, favoring his bum knee. "Have you seen Chub?" "Boo!" Chub yelled, jumping out, struggling to disentangle himself from the brambles. Rich smacked a palm to his chest in mock fright. Chub beamed. Scout nosed his ear. Without brothers or sisters, the dog was his most loyal playmate. Rich swung Chub across Damnation Creek, 12 feet wide, clear and deep, numbing cold, one of the last creek salmon still came back to. Colleen stood on the bank, watching Rich wade over to check the catch on the pipe that ran water around the bend and down gradient all the way to their tank. Satisfied, he sloshed toward her. She stood over him. He smiled at the reversal in their heights, his sheared brown curls silver around the ears. He set his hands on her waist, and although she knew better, her heart leapt. His callous thumbs on her hip bones, heat and pressure, his clean soap smell. He tipped her upside down over his shoulder. "Rich!" she shrieked. He splashed across and set her down, flushed and laughing, on the opposite bank. He was blushing too, that goofy, lopsided grin of his. She felt a surge of foolish hope. "Let's try again. Let's keep trying." She was only 34 years old. Why shouldn't she have another child? By crossing the creek, they'd crossed into Lower Damnation Grove, company property. Old-growth redwoods as wide as houses towered overhead, shafts of morning light filtering down through the needles, casting a greenish tint over everything. "Where are we going?" Chub asked, hushed. The big trees made them all lower their voices. "Almost there," Rich said. They climbed the steep rise toward the culvert, where Damnation Creek spilled out from under the gravel road that cut the grove in two, separating the lower half from the upper. "What road is this?" Chub asked. "No name road," Colleen said, "the way we go to Aunt Enid's." The side leaving the woods was cratered with potholes, the roadside overgrown with yellowing brush. The tank truck must have been by. The company did a good job of keeping the road sprayed. A company road was better than a county road, better than a Forest Service road. The government sprayed once in the spring, but Sanderson's spray truck worked year-round. By tomorrow, alder and brambles, trashed trees and weeds, everything the spray had touched that wasn't a needle tree, a cache tree, a redwood, or a fir, would curl and die, leaving the road wide enough for two log trucks to pass in opposite directions. "What creek is this?" is the real question, Rich said, water gushing down from the upper grove. Chub thought for a moment. "Every Gunderson is born with a map of Del Norte County in the palm of his hand," Rich hinted. Chub consulted his palm. The forest was a maze. Between the fog and the sound of falling water, it was easy to lose your sense of direction, rare to find a spot where you could see farther than the next ridge. Men who'd grown up in these woods still got lost hunting in them. Walk in one direction for a few minutes and the forest rotated. Before long, you stood dizzy, like a child spun in circles, blinking with the sudden disorientation of having a blindfold removed. But not Rich. Drop Rich in the woods in the pitch black, and it would take him 10 seconds to chart a path home. He was determined to teach Chub the way he claimed his own father had taught him, though he hadn't been much older than Chub when his father was killed. Rich ran a thumb up Chub's lifeline to orient him. "Damnation Creek?" Chub guessed. "Good," Rich said. "If you know your creeks, you can always find your way home."
If you know your creeks. Love that. At this time, we'd love to take some audience questions. So the question is, that the characters came to you fully formed and what that moment was like when they arrived to you that way.
I just sort of wondered why they were so quiet. And I think that There's a particular challenge in writing inward characters because so much of their communication between Rich and Colleen is nonverbal. And, you know, the force with which she sets down a coffee cup, he very distinctly gets a message from that. And it was difficult for me to sort of pull that out of them. And I have a good friend who's a novelist, who's also a screenwriter, who had explained to me that my problem was that the book was too realistic, that this was too much the way a real marriage would work. That, like, you don't have to say much. When you've been married many years, you know a person well enough that you're very attuned to sort of these micro gestures. And that to write fiction where that would come across, you had to make it a little bit more obvious, and they had to talk more. And so it started out all in Rich's perspective. It was a first-person novel in his point of view for 2 years. And then I realized there were just all these rooms in the book that he couldn't walk into, you know, figuratively, but also literally. Like, he couldn't walk into Melody's bedroom when she's in labor. He couldn't walk into the kitchen in Enid's trailer and sit down and sort of ask what was on her mind. And so I had to add Colleen's perspective, because she could walk into those rooms, and women would confide in her in a way that Rich just, they wouldn't in Rich. But they were both still really quiet and pretty serious individuals. And so I added Chubb because, if I can say so myself, he's a delight. And and I also think that he's just literally a lot closer to the ground than his parents. And he's, at that age, he's so alive to the magic of the natural world. And I think that because he's so young, the adults around him will say things that they don't think a child is catching. And I think as adults, we do this a lot with kids, thinking that we can have a conversation at a register that they're not going to understand. And I think that may be true. They may not get all the nuance, but I think kids are pretty darn good at taking the temperature of a room. And so I think a lot of the hard scenes in the book, that the emotional weight of those scenes would be so much for Rich or Colleen, Chubb can take you into them as a reader and not be sort of oppressed by that weight. And so I did understand why I needed all of them. It would have been more helpful if they were more chatty by disposition, but they're not.
Well, Ash, thank you so much for being here, for coming up to Portland to talk to us about your beautiful book. Thank you for this offering. Thank you so much, everybody, for being here.
Thank you.
That was Ash Davidson in conversation with Jacqueline Fitzgerald from the Portland Book Festival in 2021. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. The Archive Project is produced in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori and Donald Orr for radio and podcast, with production oversight by Amanda Bullock and support from Liz Olofsson. I'm the executive producer. Special thanks to Literary Arts marketing staff, Jyoti Roy and Hope Levy, and the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of The Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.